Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we cut through the noise, examine the evidence, and get to the core of what truly matters for you. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy, ready to help you navigate these intricate landscapes of information.
Today, we're embarking on a crucial deep dive titled The Federal News Update for Thursday, August 28th, 2025.
Right.
Our mission for you is to provide an exhaustive, granular look at every significant action and activity of the U.S. federal government since the beginning of August 27, 2025.
Yeah, we've got a stack of sources here, official proclamations, EOs, reports, analyses.
Exactly. And we're going to really unpack what these developments mean for all of us. Think of it as your essential shortcut to being incredibly well-informed.
Mm-hmm.
We want to transform what could be an overwhelming torrent of information into clear, actionable insights and, you know, hopefully more than a few aha moments.
Indeed. And this isn't just a routine news recap, is it? The past 48 hours, they've been characterized by an unusually intense period of decisive and, frankly, impactful policy implementation.
And almost entirely from the executive branch.
Almost entirely, yes. And what's particularly striking is how this happened within a very specific strategic vacuum, Congress being out of session.
Ah, okay. The recess.
Precisely. This void effectively seeded the national stage. It allowed the administration to push forward with some remarkably controversial and far-reaching policies without that immediate legislative challenge.
Or the intense public debate you'd normally get from hearings.
Exactly. No hearings, no immediate pushback on the floor.
That's a powerful observation. An administrative blitzkrieg, perhaps?
That's a good way to put it, actually. It feels very much like an administrative blitzkrieg was deployed.
Mm-hmm.
A rapid, multi-front offensive, really, designed to maximize impact while immediate opposition was muted.
Covering quite a range of areas, too.
Oh, absolutely. We've seen aggressive executive action touching upon crucial areas like criminal justice reform, international trade, immigration policy, even public health.
Yeah.
Often challenging established norms and institutions.
And the courts played a role, too, even during recess.
They did. As we'll discuss, the Supreme Court played a pivotal, if procedural, role as an arbiter in one key case. It provided what amounts to a practical victory for the executive's agenda there.
Okay.
So, yeah, we'll delve into each of these specific actions, their consequences,
yeah.
Legal, economic, geopolitical. It's been an intense period, one that truly lays out a detailed blueprint for this administration's approach to governance.
All right, let's unpack this because it's been a truly eventful 48 hours. We should start our deep dive right at the top, shouldn't we? Actions directly from the White House and the executive office of the president.
Oh, good.
Okay, so kicking things off, on August 27th, we saw a presidential proclamation. This one was to honor victims in Minneapolis.
Right, a tragic event there.
Yes. And this was a fairly conventional, symbolic presidential response, ordering the flag of the United States be flown at half staff. You know,
yeah.
White House, public buildings, military posts, facilities abroad.
Mm-hmm. Standard procedure for marking national grief.
Exactly. It was issued, and I'm quoting here, as a mark of respect for the victims of the senseless acts of violence perpetrated on August 27, 2025 in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
And these kinds of symbolic gestures, while they don't change policy, they are incredibly important, aren't they, for setting a national tone?
Yeah, demonstrating empathy, unity.
Exactly. It's often the very first official presidential action we see after such tragic events. It's about conveying national mourning, signaling unity, even if brief, in the face of loss.
Especially important in divided times, maybe.
I think so. Those moments of collective remembrance can carry significant weight, reminding us of a shared humanity.
But just as the nation paused for that moment, the White House pivoted to something far more contentious, policy-wise.
Oh, yes, the executive order.
We're talking about Executive Order 13340, measures to end cashless bail and enforce the law in the District of Columbia. Now, it was signed earlier, but it's official publication in the Federal Register on August 28th that formalized this major federal push against state and local criminal justice reforms.
And the core threat is withholding federal funds.
Yes, exactly. Threatening to withhold or even revoke federal funding from jurisdictions that have implemented cashless bail policies. The president himself was quoted quite starkly on it. He said, no cash. Come back in a couple of months. We'll give you a trial. You never see the person again.
Strong words.
Yeah.
And this isn't just about DC, is it? Despite the title.
No, not at all. That seems clear.
And this is a really significant move, Alex. It has broad implications for states across the country. Just to clarify for you listening, cashless bail, at its core, means allowing defendants to be released from jail without having to pay money, a bond while they wait for trial.
Based on risk assessment, not ability to pay.
Generally, yes. The administration's rationale, laid out in the EO, frames this as a direct threat to public safety. They argue it leads to an increase in crime.
Do they cite evidence for that?
They point to data, yeah. Like a 2022 study from Yolo County, California, it found 70.6% of defendants released under a temporary cashless bail system, they were rearrested. So this executive order directly targets states like Illinois. They were the first to abolish cash bail entirely back in 2023, but also New Jersey, New Mexico, and Washington, D.C., places that have significantly reduced their reliance on cash bail.
So it's a real assertion of federal authority into what's usually state business.
Precisely. Historically, criminal justice, bail systems, that's been state-level stuff.
But this isn't a universally accepted perspective, is it? I mean, the idea that cashless bail inherently increases crime, there are strong arguments on the other side.
Oh, absolutely. Very strong arguments, rooted in fairness and equity principles. Proponents of bail reform argue that cash bail, well, it unconstitutionally penalizes poverty.
Right. If you're poor, you stay in jail, even if you're low risk. Uh-oh. If you're wealthy, you get out.
Exactly. It creates a two-tiered system. And they also cite countervailing studies that challenge the administration's narrative. For instance, there was a 2024 Loyola University Chicago report on Illinois' law. It concluded crime rates hadn't increased a year after it was implemented.
Okay, so conflicting data.
And another one, a 2024 Brennan Center for Justice study, found no statistically significant relationship between bail reform efforts and overall crime rates. So, yeah, the debate is complex. Passionate arguments, data points on both sides. It's not clear-cut.
So if the data is contested and the issue is traditionally handled by states, what does this executive order really mean for the bigger picture? For federalism? For you, the citizen, whose state might be targeted?
Well, look, the issuance of this IO represents a truly significant assertion of federal power into state and local territory.
Using the power of the PERF.
Exactly. By leveraging that powerful tool, federal funding, the administration is trying to compel policy changes where it lacks direct constitutional authority to just pass a law.
Right. They can't just mandate states abolish cashless bail or reinstate it.
Correct. So they use financial leverage. This move transforms what was largely a state-level policy debate into a national political flashpoint. It creates a clear wedge issue.
Framing the administration as tough on crime versus
what they'd portray as soft on crime policies. It appeals directly to a certain segment of the electorate, and it raises that fundamental question. How far can federal power extend into state domains using financial leverage?
And legal challenges seem inevitable.
Almost certain, yeah. From affected states.
Yeah.
It's going to escalate conflicts over federalism, over the scope of executive authority. And these battles, they'll put the judiciary right back in the center of another major policy fight.
The implications for the federal-state balance could be profound, long-lasting.
Definitely. A really key development to watch.
Okay. Shifting gears slightly, but staying with the White House. Another proclamation, this one more solemn but still politically charged, you could say.
Yeah.
On August 28th.
The Abbeygate anniversary.
Yes. Commemorating the fourth anniversary of that 2021 terrorist attack at Abbeygate outside the Kabul airport, 13 U.S. service members killed during the withdrawal from Afghanistan.
A horrific event. And these commemorations, they often serve a dual purpose, don't they?
How so?
Well, on one hand, it's absolutely about honoring military sacrifice, remembering those who died, acknowledging the loss for their families, for the nation. That's paramount.
Of course.
But on the other hand, it undeniably functions as a political touchstone. It implicitly references the very contentious, widely criticized end of the war in Afghanistan, which happened under the previous administration.
So it serves as a reminder, a subtle critique.
It can be read that way, yes. A reminder of past decisions, their consequences, a point of reflection. And the Department of Defense issued its own statement, too, honoring the fallen. It underscores the gravity and the ongoing political resonance of that event.
Got it. Okay, finally, within the White House sphere, the press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, held a briefing on August 28th. We don't have a full transcript yet, but we can probably guess some key themes, right, based on past performance.
I think we can infer quite a bit, yeah, given the rapid-fire policy actions we've just discussed.
Like the cashless bail-io.
Exactly. Yeah. And crucially, the massive turmoil at the CDC, which we absolutely need to get into next. It's highly likely the briefing served to amplify and defend those actions.
And what's her typical approach?
Well, past briefings by this press secretary have consistently focused on themes like restoring common sense to government, taking decisive action on immigration, the economy. and promoting a specific media strategy.
Which involves?
Engaging directly with non-traditional outlets, podcasters, social media influencers, bypassing the legacy media, often taking a confrontational stance with them. It's about shaping the narrative directly.
Controlling the message.
Pretty much. And interestingly, there were reports unconfirmed, but circulating that the briefing might have also touched on emerging economic policy ideas. Specifically, the administration reportedly weighing taking a 10% stake in Intel, the chipmaker.
Wow, a 10% stake? That's direct intervention.
Highly significant and unusual, yes. Moving beyond just regulation to direct ownership in a critical industry, if true, that's something you, the listener, should definitely keep an eye on. It signals a potentially bolder, more interventionist economic approach.
Okay, let's move on then. From the White House, our next stop takes us into the heart of what you called a truly alarming institutional tremor at Health and Human Services.
Yes. HHS was absolutely at the epicenter of federal activity during this period.
And you said this is where it gets really interesting, maybe even alarming, a profound crisis in public health leadership.
That's not an exaggeration, unfortunately. We're talking about the firing of the CDC director, Dr. Susan Monterez, and the subsequent leadership exodus. This wasn't just a personnel change. You called it an institutional earthquake, and I think that's accurate. It reverberated throughout the entire public health community. Things escalated incredibly quickly on August 27th and 28th.
Okay, walk us through it. How did this unfold?
All right, well, this is perhaps the most critical and, frankly, unsettling development in this 48-hour window. Many public health experts view this as reaching the level of a national security event.
National security? Wow.
Yes. It began on the afternoon of August 27th. HHS announced via a post on X, the social media platform, that Dr. Susan Monterez is no longer director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Just flat out.
Okay, but she contested that.
Immediately and very publicly. Her legal team fired back, stating unequivocally she had not resigned, nor had she been formally fired according to proper procedure. They argued that as a Senate-confirmed presidential appointee, only the president himself could lawfully remove her, and only through specific processes.
A direct challenge to HHS's authority.
And they went further. Her lawyers asserted, in very strong language, that she was being targeted by the HHS secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., because she refused to, and this is their quote, rubber stamp, unscientific, reckless directives, and fire dedicated health experts.
Well,
they accused the department of attempting to weaponize public health for political gain. I mean, that set the stage for a really dramatic public standoff.
That's an extraordinary accusation, weaponizing public health. How did the White House step in? Did they resolve this very public, very serious clash?
They did have to step in. Late on August 27th, the White House intervened. A spokesperson confirmed Dr. Monterez had indeed been terminated. The stated reason, she was not aligned with the president's agenda of making America healthy again and had been fired after she refused to resign despite informing HHS leadership of her intent to do so.
So the White House backed the HHS secretary?
Effectively, yes. That ended the dispute over her legal status. She was out. But the stated reasons, that just deepened the concerns for many in the public health world.
And this wasn't just about her, right? She'd only been confirmed by the Senate less than a month before. This termination triggered something unprecedented at the CDC itself.
That's exactly right. Within hours of the White House confirmation, an immediate and truly unprecedented exodus of the CDC's top scientific leadership began. Mass resignations.
How many people are we talking about?
At least four senior officials. All widely respected, decades of experience. This included Dr. Debra Howery. She was the CDC's chief medical officer and deputy director for program and science.
Yeah.
Essentially the agency's scientific backbone.
Okay, a huge loss already.
Then Dr. Daniel Jernigan, director of the National Center for Emerging and Zoonotic Infectious Diseases, NCEZID. That's the division responsible for defending against new threats like Ebola, novel coronaviruses, think pandemic preparedness central.
Oh, my goodness.
And Dr. Dimitri Daskalakis, director of the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases, NCIRD. That's the heart of the nation's vaccine programs and policies.
The vaccine programs. Unbelievable.
And Dr. Jennifer Layden, director of the Office of Public Health Data, Surveillance, and Technology. She oversees the critical data infrastructure. These weren't just random managers. These were the absolute linchpins of the CDC's operational and scientific capacity. Gone in hours.
And the resignation letters, I heard they weren't just standard thank you and goodbye notes.
Not even close. They were scathing. expressing profound, alarming concerns about scientific integrity at the agency. The language was remarkably strong for career public servants.
Like what?
Well, Dr. Daskalakis, for instance, wrote he was unable to serve in an environment that treats CDC as a tool to generate policies and materials that do not reflect scientific reality. He described Dr. Monterez as having been hamstrung and sidelined by an authoritarian leader, directly echoing her lawyer's claims.
Wow.
And Dr. Howery, in her letter, lamented the impact of budget cuts, political interference. She stated unequivocally that the science at CDC should never be censored or subject to political pauses or interpretations.
So open accusations of political interference in science.
Blatantly, yes. And the reactions from outside experts were just as stark. One former White House official called it a total implosion, a wholesale destruction of leadership. Another professor warned, this is pure chaos that leaves the country unprepared. These aren't minor gripes. These are grave warnings about the foundation of public health in the U.S.
So, Sam, what is the ultimate impact of this institutional decapitation, as you put it? It sounds like it goes far beyond just personnel changes, like a fundamental weakening of our defenses.
It absolutely does. And the gravity of this cannot be overstated. You simultaneously remove a Senate-confirmed director and the heads of your core immunization and emerging disease centers. That is an effective institutional decapitation.
Decades of experience just walked out the door.
Decades of cumulative experience, institutional memory, leadership, gone. From the very organization tasked with preventing, detecting, responding to existential public health threats, future pandemics, bioterrorism, you name it.
So for you, the listener, this means?
It means the agency designed to protect your family from disease outbreaks is now demonstrably less capable, period. The public allegations of political interference that will have a profoundly chilling effect on the remaining staff. It'll make it harder to attract top talent in the future.
And damage credibility.
Severely. With the American public, with the international community. CDC's credibility is built on trust in its scientific integrity, its nonpartisanship. This action creates a first-order national security vulnerability. It leaves the U.S. demonstrably less prepared for the next major health crisis, whatever that might be. This is truly a crisis that cuts to the core of our nation's ability to protect its citizens.
Just staggering. Okay, but beyond the CDC crisis, HHS also launched another significant initiative during this period, didn't it? Something called the Make America Healthy Again Nutrition Initiative.
Yes, on August 27th, with support for the Department of Education. This initiative formally urges America's leading medical education organizations to immediately implement comprehensive nutrition education and training.
Based on what rationale?
Secretary Kennedy highlighted what he called a critical shortcoming. He said, medical schools talk about nutrition but fail to teach it. And noted that an estimated 1 million Americans die annually from diet-related chronic diseases.
Okay, so what's the actual directive? What are they asking these organizations to do?
It's quite specific, actually,
and
represents a pretty bold move into territory usually left to academic bodies. HHS directed these organizations, the ones accrediting med schools, setting board exams, etc., to submit written plans by September 10th.
That's a very tight deadline.
Extremely tight. Plans detailing how they'll embed nutrition education requirements across six critical areas.
Which are?
Pre-medical standards, ensuring future doctors have a foundation. Medical school curricula, making it core training. Licensing exams, requiring competency. Residency requirements, applying it in practice. Board certification, demonstrating specialized knowledge. And continuing education, keeping doctors updated.
So covering the entire life cycle of a doctor's training and career.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Now look, the goal of improving nutrition education, combating chronic disease, that's a widely shared public health objective. Nobody really disputes that.
But the method is the issue.
Exactly. This top-down directive represents a very significant federal intervention into medical training standards and curricula. These areas are traditionally governed by independent academic and professional bodies like the LCME or specialty boards, not direct federal mandates.
So what does this mean for you, whether you're a future doctor or just a patient?
Well, it's a clear example of the administration's willingness to challenge established institutional norms, to bypass traditional pathways to advance its policy agenda. It signals a top-down, assertive approach to public health issues, a significant shift in how these standards are usually set and maintained. It's about centralizing control, to some extent, over what future doctors learn about health.
Very interesting. Okay, let's shift now to the Department of Homeland Security. DHS initiated two incredibly significant policy actions, you said. One with immediate severe economic fallout, the other with long-term strategic implications for higher education.
That's right. big moves from DHS.
Let's start with the economic one, the implementation of punitive tariffs on India.
Yeah, this kicked in effective 12:21 a.m. Eastern Time on August 27th. U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, started implementing President Trump's Executive Order 14329.
And this imposes an additional 25% duty.
Correct. An additional 25% ad valorem duty, meaning based on the value of the goods on a wide range of products imported from India. And crucially, this is on top of existing tariffs.
So for many goods, the total tariff is now 50%?
Effectively, yes.
That's it.
For many Indian goods entering the U.S., the total duty hits 50%. That's a massive barrier.
What's the administration's stated reason for such a drastic measure against a country often seen as a strategic partner?
The rationale is rooted officially in national security. The executive order, the implementing notice, they explicitly link these tariffs to the fact that India is, quote, directly or indirectly importing Russian Federation oil.
Ah, the Russia connection.
Yes, which the president has determined contributes to the threat posed by Russia and the ongoing national emergency related to its actions in Eastern Europe. So this isn't primarily framed as being about trade deficits or unfair practices.
It's using economic leverage for geopolitical alignment.
Clearly. It's a blunt instrument attempt to pressure India to reduce its economic ties with Russia.
And the economic impact on India, projections sound pretty severe, like it could cripple entire industry.
Absolutely. The projections are quite dire. India ships about $86.5 billion in goods to the U.S. annually. We're their single largest export market.
Huge reliance.
Huge. According to analysis by the Global Trade Research Initiative, or GTRI, roughly $60.2 billion of those exports will now face this staggering 50% tariff.
Wow. Most of their exports to the U.S.
A very large chunk. And the impact will be felt most acutely in labor-intensive sectors. Think apparel, textiles.
Where they compete with countries like
Bangladesh, Vietnam.
Yeah.
Countries that don't face these punitive tariffs. Analysts project Indian goods in these sectors will just be priced out of the market. GTRI's founder estimated exports from affected sectors could plummet by as much as 70%.
70%. That's devastating.
It threatens hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of jobs in India. And for you, the consumer here, this could mean changes in availability, pricing of goods previously sourced from India clothing, maybe electronics components, other things.
How's the Indian government reacting? Are they buckling under the pressure?
Not at all, actually. They've adopted a remarkably defiant posture. Prime Minister Modi framed this as an era of economic selfishness by other nations, vowed India would withstand the pressure.
So they're digging in.
Seems like it. Reports say New Delhi is accelerating domestic reforms, like restructuring their goods and services tax to boost internal consumption, reduce export reliance, and they're actively trying to fast-track trade deals with others, the UK, the EU.
Diversifying away from the US market.
A clear effort to do just that, given how volatile it's just proven to be for them.
This feels like more than just trade, though. It's a high-stakes geopolitical gamble, isn't it? What are the broader implications for U.S. foreign policy, especially in the Indo-Pacific?
It absolutely is a high-stakes gamble. For years, there's been a bipartisan consensus in Washington viewing a strong relationship with India as a cornerstone of U.S. strategy in the Indo-Pacific, essential for counterbalancing China's growing influence.
And this undermines that.
It directly challenges India's longstanding foreign policy of strategic autonomy. Their approach of balancing relationships with multiple powers, including their historic defense partner, Russia.
So the U.S. is forcing them to choose.
Essentially, yes. Using this powerful economic weapon to force a choice between their energy defense ties with Moscow and access to the crucial U.S. market, this risks alienating a critical strategic partner.
What are the potential downsides for the U.S.?
Well, a severely damaged Indian economy could lead to domestic instability there. Or it could push India closer to other powers, potentially even China, the very outcome the U.S. wants to prevent. This could undermine U.S. strategic objectives in the region, maybe weaken alliances like the Quad.
U.S., India, Japan, Australia.
Right, or other regional partnerships. It's a bold play, but one with potentially significant unintended consequences for global strategic dynamics. Really something to watch.
Okay, let's turn to the other major DHS action, a proposed rule to end duration of status for F and J visas. On August 28th, DHS published this Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, aiming to dismantle a longstanding policy for students and exchange visitors.
Yes, the F visa is for academic students, J is for exchange visitors like scholars, researchers, interns.
And this duration of status, or DS, yeah, what is that exactly?
So right now, under DS, it's been in place since the late 80s, early 90s, F and J visa holders are admitted to the U.S. for the entire time required to complete their academic program or exchange activity, plus any authorized practical training period afterwards.
So as long as you're enrolled and following the rules, your status is generally valid.
Exactly. Think of it like your status is valid for the duration of your program. The proposed rule would scrap that entirely.
And replace it with?
A fixed period of admission, generally not to exceed 4 years.
Only 4 years. What about PhD programs or programs that take longer?
Good question. And for some, including students from countries with visa overstay rates above 10%, that initial period could be limited to just 2 years.
2 years? That barely covers an associate's degree sometimes.
Right. So to stay longer, maybe finish that PhD, change academic levels, do optional practical training or OPT, which is critical for many.
The post-graduation work authorization.
Yes.
Yes.
Individuals would have to proactively apply for an extension of stay with USCIS, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services.
Adding another layer of bureaucracy and uncertainty, what's the administration's rationale for this huge change?
Their stated rationale is enhancing national security and monitoring. They argue the current DS system allows foreign nationals to remain in the U.S. virtually indefinitely without sufficient oversight.
But the higher education community disagrees.
Vehemently. It's been met with universal condemnation from groups like the American Council on Education, ACE, NAFSA, Association of International Educators. They call it a solution in search of a problem.
Why?
They argue international students are already the most closely monitored non-immigrant group through the federal SEVIS database.
The Student and Exchange Visitor Information System.
Right. It tracks their enrollment status, address, compliance with visa rules in real time. Right. They're essentially saying the oversight needed for security is already built into the current system.
So what are the specific worries, the potential burdens for students and universities if this rule goes through? Sounds like more than just paperwork.
Oh, far more. It's a profound shift. It would create immense bureaucratic burdens and deep uncertainty for the roughly 1.6 million international students and scholars currently here and anyone thinking of coming.
How so?
Well, that extension of stay process, it would be costly, likely lengthy, and highly discretionary, introducing a huge, unpredictable element into their academic and career plans. Imagine being halfway through a complex research project for your PhD.
And your ability to finish depends on an extension being approved, potentially after delays.
Precisely. Plus, the rule adds new academic restrictions, like barring undergrads from changing majors in their first year, which happens all the time, or prohibiting students from getting a second degree at the same or lower level.
Why restrict academic choices like that?
The rationale isn't entirely clear, but it adds another layer of rigidity. And perhaps most concerning for you, the student, is the risk of accruing unlawful presence.
How would that happen?
If a student unknowingly overstays their fixed end date by even one day, maybe because USCIS is slow processing an extension, or just a misunderstanding, they could start accruing unlawful presence. That triggers multi-year bars on re-entering the U.S.
A severe penalty for potentially an administrative issue.
Extremely severe.
So this isn't just a procedural tweak. It sounds like it could fundamentally reshape international education in the U.S., driving away talent and money.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If finalized, this policy would almost certainly have a significant chilling effect, discouraging prospective students and scholars from choosing the U.S.
Driving them to competitors.
Canada, the U.K., Australia. Countries with more welcoming, more predictable immigration systems. This would have immediate substantial economic consequences. International students contribute tens of billions to the U.S. economy annually. Tuition, housing, spending, supporting countless jobs.
And the long-term impact.
Long-term strategic damage. It diminishes a key pillar of American soft power. It cuts off a vital pipeline of global talent that has historically fueled U.S. innovation, science, tech, research. Impacting everything from medical breakthroughs to new industries.
So it raises that important question. What's the long-term cost of these perceived short-term security gains when you factor in the hit to the economy, universities, global standing?
A very critical question indeed.
Okay, from DHS's big moves on borders and visas, let's move to the Treasury Department. FinCEN, specifically, battling a more insidious threat, global money laundering networks. And you said this ties directly to the fentanyl crisis here.
Directly, yes. Mm-hmm. On August 27th and 28th, Treasury's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, FinCEN, issued a comprehensive advisory and a financial trend analysis on Chinese money laundering networks, or CMLNs.
Highlighting a pervasive threat linked to fentanyl.
Right. The primary purpose is to alert U.S. financial institutions to be extremely vigilant in detecting the use of these CMLNs by Mexico-based transnational criminal organizations, TCOs.
Like the cartels.
Exactly. Like the Jalisco New Generation Cartel, CGNG, and the Sinaloa Cartel, both of which the administration has designated as foreign terrorist organizations, by the way.
And this FinCEN analysis, how extensive was it?
Incredibly extensive, based on a staggering 137,153 Bank Secrecy Act reports filed between 2020 and 2024. Those reports collectively flagged approximately $312 billion in suspicious transactions potentially linked to these CMLNs.
$312 billion, that's almost incomprehensible.
It's a massive hidden flow of illicit funds, undermining our financial integrity and directly fueling the opioid crisis.
So how exactly do these Chinese money laundering networks work with the cartels? You mentioned a symbiotic relationship.
It's intricate and mutually beneficial, exploiting different needs. Yeah. The Mexican cartels, they need to launder vast sums of illicit U.S. dollars from drug sales, mainly fentanyl flooding the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
They have tons of cash here they need to move out, convert into usable funds elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But banks are watching. At the same time, the CMLNs serve a large client base. Wealthy Chinese nationals trying to evade China's strict currency controls to move their wealth out of China.
Limits on how much money they can legally transfer abroad.
Exactly. So the CMLNs act as highly efficient middlemen. They buy the cartel's dirty U.S. dollars, usually at a discount. That helps the cartels clean their money quickly, get it out of the U.S. system.
And then the CMLNs.
They sell that now cleaner money to their Chinese clients who want funds outside China. Completing this complex financial circle that benefits both the criminals and the individuals evading their own government's controls. It's like a hidden financial highway.
What are the typical methods, the typologies FinCEN is warning banks about? Are there red flags for average people too?
The advisory highlights several key methods. Sophisticated trade-based money laundering using import-export businesses to mask flows. Complex real estate deals in high-value U.S. markets parking dirty money and property. And widespread use of money mules.
Individuals moving money through their accounts.
Right. And what's particularly alarming, something FinCEN specifically warns about, relevant for you listening, is that CMLNs are increasingly recruiting Chinese students at U.S. universities to act as these mules.
Exploiting students.
Yes. Exploiting their need for funds, maybe their unfamiliarity with U.S. financial laws, restrictions on lawful work. FinCEN gives banks a detailed list of red flag indicators, unusual transaction patterns, sudden unexplained wealth, things like that.
It's fascinating how this connects global finance, the opioid crisis, and points fingers at specific actors. What are the broader implications, the dual purposes of this advisory?
It serves a crucial dual purpose. Practically, it significantly heightens the compliance burden for U.S. financial institutions. They have to enhance monitoring, detect these schemes. They're on notice.
And geopolitically?
It publicly and officially links PRC nationals and financial systems to the fentanyl crisis, one of the most devastating domestic issues in the U.S. right now. This isn't subtle. It's a direct accusation.
Reinforcing the administration's hard line.
Towards both the Chinese government implicating its citizens and financial system and the Mexican cartels by intensifying financial pressure. It effectively uses financial intelligence as a potent tool of foreign policy and national security, disrupting the money flows that fuel both drug trade and capital flight.
Okay, let's turn now to national security more directly. The Department of Defense, they were active too, strengthening alliances and securing their own supply chain.
Yes, some important moves from the Pentagon.
On August 27th, the Defense Security Cooperation Agency, DSCA, notified Congress about two potential foreign military sales, or FMS standard practice, but strategically vital.
Absolutely. These are important sales, reinforcing U.S. commitment to allies.
Right.
The first is a possible sale to the NATO Support and Procurement Agency, NSPA, up to 96 AM-9X Sidewinder Block 2 tactical missiles plus guidance units, estimated cost, $103.9 million.
And who are those for?
They're for Belgium, Italy, and Romania, specifically to equip their F-35 aircraft fleets. A crucial upgrade to their air defense capabilities. For you listening, that means a stronger NATO front line.
And the second sale?
Much larger. A possible sale to Poland for F-35 sustainment and logistical support. Estimated cost, $1.85 billion. This isn't just selling planes. It's a long-term commitment to keep those advanced systems flying and fighting.
So what's the bigger picture here, the strategic significance?
Well, these proposed sales clearly demonstrate continued U.S. commitment to strengthening NATO allies, especially those on the eastern flank closest to Russia. They enhance interoperability with U.S. forces, everyone using similar advanced gear like the F-35 and its munitions. That's vital for coordinated defense.
Bolstering collective defense against potential Russian aggression.
Precisely. And of course, it also supports the U.S. defense industrial base. keeps our factories busy, keeps innovation going. It's a clear signal of long-term strategic investments and alliances and shared security in a pretty volatile region.
Beyond selling hardware, DoD also finalized a rule on contractor conflicts of interest, published August 25th, effective late October, amending the Defense Acquisition Regulations, the DFARS. Sounds like tightening security around information.
It is exactly that. This rule is specifically designed to mitigate conflicts of interest when contractors work for both the DoD and foreign adversaries.
How does it do that?
It explicitly prohibits contracting officers from awarding contracts for consulting services, specifically under certain industry codes covering management, scientific, technical consulting, to any company that, along with its subsidiaries or affiliates, also holds contracts for consulting with a covered foreign entity.
And covered foreign entity means?
Governments like China, Russia, others specifically identified as strategic competitors or adversaries. The only way around it is if the contractor has a formal conflict of interest mitigation plan approved by the contracting officer, showing how they'll wall off information and loyalties.
So, connecting this to the bigger picture for us.
It's a significant step to de-risk the defense supply chain, ensure the integrity of strategic advice. It forces a stark choice on the global consulting industry. You can work with US DoD, a huge client, or entities linked to China and Russia, but generally not both, unless you have very strong, verifiable safeguards.
Countering foreign influence and intelligence gathering within that consulting world.
Exactly. A direct attempt to do that. Recognizing the complex web of global business interests and trying to untangle it for national security purposes. Making sure sensitive advice isn't compromised.
Okay. While some departments were making these huge waves, others seemed quieter, more routine, but maybe with implications for how government works.
Yeah, not every department was operating at the same tempo.
Let's talk about the Department of Justice, DOJ, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, ATF. Their public activity seemed mostly routine law enforcement announcements.
That's right. Over August 27th and 28th, press releases from various U.S. attorneys' offices and ATF detailed indictments, guilty pleas, sentencings, bread and butter work, RICO violations, narcotics, healthcare fraud, firearms offenses, day-to-day federal law enforcement.
But what was noteworthy was the absence of.
The almost complete absence of major policy announcements or high-profile press conferences from main DOJ headquarters in D.C.
Which contrasted.
State attorneys general, like California's Rob Bonta. They were very active during this same period, issuing press releases, filing lawsuits, often directly opposing Trump administration policies on immigration, environment, education funding.
So what might that contrast suggest?
It suggests a potential strategic decision by the federal DOJ, maybe focusing public communications at the local U.S. attorney level, emphasizing ground-level criminal enforcement, rather than getting entangled in the national political and policy debates driven by the White House and other departments.
So is this deliberate, trying to depoliticize the federal DOJ's image, or just a quiet spell?
Hard to say definitively. But it raises that interesting question. Is it a strategy to project an image of just focusing on law enforcement or simply a lull in their policy announcements? A subtle but important distinction in how different parts of the executive branch operate publicly.
Similarly, the Department of State also seemed relatively low-key during this intense 48 hours.
Relatively, yes. No department press briefing on the 27th. Secretary Rubio's public schedule for the 28th just showed meetings at State and the White House. Pretty standard diplomatic work.
But some key activities did happen.
Oh, yes. Traditional statecraft continued. A joint statement with Japan and South Korea on the 27th about countering North Korean IT workers who generate illicit revenue. And on the 28th, Under Secretary for Political Affairs Alison Hooker met with the EU ambassador, likely discussing ongoing transatlantic cooperation.
So the contrast here is with
the high impact, often confrontational actions from departments like DHS and Treasury, like those India tariffs, State maintained a much lower key posture.
Suggesting maybe a division of labor.
That's what's fascinating, yeah. It might indicate a clear division within the administration's foreign policy apparatus. State handles traditional diplomatic channels, alliances, the softer power stuff, while other agencies wield the hard power tools. Tariffs, sanctions, direct pressure.
Different tools for different objectives?
Exactly. A nuanced, multifaceted approach to global engagement, using different arms of the government in different ways simultaneously.
Okay, let's move away from the executive branch now and look at Congress. And here, the story seems defined by absence, a legislative silence that had real implications.
That's a very accurate way to put it, a striking absence.
Both the House and the Senate were in a scheduled recess, right? A state work period.
Correct. According to the schedule, this recess started August 4th, running through September 1st.
And the impact of that recess, especially given all the executive action.
Profound. There was zero legislative floor activity in either chamber on August 27th or 28th. The House did convene for what's called a pro forma session on the 27th.
Which is just a formality.
Purely. They came in at 11 a.m., offered a prayer, approved the previous day's journal, adjourned at 11 to 3 a.m., 3 minutes.
Literally just gaveling in and out.
Exactly. No votes, no substantive business, no committee hearings scheduled in D.C. either. Now, these recesses are normal, letting members work in their districts. But the timing of this one was strategically significant.
Creating a power vacuum.
A profound one, yes. Which the executive branch, as we've just detailed, moved aggressively to fill.
So this legislative silence wasn't just a coincidence. It was a key enabler for that administrative blitzkrieg you mentioned.
Absolutely. During these 2 days of silence from Congress, the administration executed some of its most consequential, most controversial actions. The CDC leadership purge, the India tariffs, the proposed student visa rules, the cashless bail EO.
And Congress couldn't respond immediately.
Completely unable to perform its core constitutional functions, legislation, and crucially, oversight. No committee hearings to grill officials about the CDC crisis or the India tariffs. No floor debate offering competing vision.
Shifting the balance of power.
Dramatically. Towards the presidency. Allowing the administration to set the agenda, implement policies without immediate legislative friction or public accountability via Congress. For you, the listener, that means a significant, if temporary, reduction in those checks and balances.
So what does this all mean going forward?
This legislative silence dramatically shifted the balance of power, allowing the administration to set the agenda without immediate friction. That's a crucial takeaway. When Congress returns in September, they'll be in an entirely reactive posture. Playing catch-up, forced to respond to a policy landscape fundamentally altered in their absence.
Okay, so with Congress quiet, the judicial branch stepped up as a critical arena, issuing significant rulings with major implications for executive power, international law, almost the only immediate check available.
It's certainly seemed that way during this period, yes. The courts became a key battleground.
Let's start with the Supreme Court. Even though they weren't hearing arguments, they issued a highly significant ruling on NIH grant terminations.
Yes. A ruling issued August 21st, but widely analyzed and discussed on the 27th and 28th. The case was National Institutes of Health et al. V. American Public Health Association, et al.
And this stemmed from?
A major administration decision to terminate $783 million in previously awarded NIH research grants, universities, research institutions across the country.
Based on what?
Based on new internal NIH guidance, which itself was mandated by executive orders. This guidance barred funding for research related to DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, gender identity, and COVID-19.
So targeting specific research areas, and lower courts had blocked this.
Yes. A federal district court declared both the grant cancellations and the underlying NIH guidance unlawful, said the agency exceeded its authority. The First Circuit Court of Appeals then refused the government's request to stay that ruling, so the block remained in effect.
And the administration took it to the Supreme Court on an emergency basis.
Exactly. Seeking to overturn the lower courts and let the grant terminations proceed.
And the Supreme Court's decision in this complex, maybe somewhat arcane case, how did they rule?
It was a complex, divided order. They granted the administration's request in part. Critically, they stayed the part of the lower court's order that blocked the grant terminations, meaning the administration could immediately halt the funding.
Okay, a win for the administration there. But
significantly, they left in place the part that vacated the underlying NIH guidance documents. They agreed those were likely unlawful.
So the terminations can happen, but the policy basis for them is still invalid. That seems contradictory. What was the reasoning?
Justice Barrett, writing for the majority, centered on a jurisdictional distinction. She argued it required two-track litigation, the challenge to the guidance documents itself. That properly belongs in federal district court under the Administrative Procedure Act, the APA, which governs how agencies make rules.
Okay.
But the challenge to the grant terminations, that, she argued, is essentially a claim for money against the government. And under the Tucker Act, those claims belong in the exclusive jurisdiction of a different court, the U.S. Court of Federal Claims, or CFC.
So different courts for different parts of the same fight. This sounds like a procedural ruling with huge practical consequences. You called it a strategic win for the executive.
It absolutely is. While it looks like a split decision on a technicality, the practical effect is a decisive victory for the administration's immediate policy goal. Stop the money flowing to research they oppose.
The funding halts immediately.
Immediately. And Justice Jackson, in a sharp dissent, pointed out that grant recipients are now sent on a likely futile multi-venue quest for complete relief. That could take years. They have to fight the guidance issue in district court and the funding issue separately in the Court of Federal Claims.
So this provides a potential roadmap for the administration to defund other programs they dislike.
Precisely. By framing funding disputes as contract-like matters for the CFC, they can bypass potentially quicker or more sympathetic district courts and achieve their policy aims while the legal challenges get bogged down in a lengthy, complex, notoriously slow process.
Creating a chilling effect for anyone relying on federal grants.
A powerful chilling effect. Universities, research institutions, nonprofits, they become extremely cautious about pursuing research areas that might fall out of favor. It really reshapes the landscape for federally funded research, shifting the risk and burden onto the researchers themselves. A very strategic procedural victory with far-reaching consequences.
Okay, beyond the Supreme Court, federal appellate courts were also active. Maybe less high profile, but setting important precedents.
Yes, significant activity there too. Starting with the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York, two noteworthy rulings.
Oh, really?
First, a major decision regarding Afghanistan. The Second Circuit upheld a district court ruling that $3.5 billion in frozen assets belonging to Afghanistan's central bank cannot be seized to satisfy judgments held by 9/11 victims against the Taliban.
Why not?
The court reasoned that turning over sovereign funds would effectively be an official recognition of the Taliban as Afghanistan's legitimate government, something no country has done and which would run counter to U.S. foreign policy.
So the ruling preserves those assets?
Yes. For potential future use in humanitarian relief for the Afghan people, rather than going to individual judgments, a decision with profound humanitarian implications.
And the Second Circuit ruling, related to the business world, Peloton.
That's right. A split decision, partially reviving a securities fraud class action lawsuit by Peloton investors. The court found most of the company's alleged misstatements weren't actionable, but three specific statements were potentially misleading.
Like what?
Including one where an executive described a price cut as an absolutely offensive strategy rather than maybe a defensive move to clear excess inventory. The court said that was plausibly misleading to investors.
So important for you, the investor, clarifying what counts as misrepresentation.
Exactly. The case goes back to the district court for further proceedings, gives those investors another shot.
Okay, moving west to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. They had a groundbreaking ruling on algorithmic pricing and antitrust law. A first.
It is indeed. A first ever U.S. appellate ruling on this really modern, complex issue. They affirmed the dismissal of a Sherman Act lawsuit against a group of Las Vegas hotels.
What was the allegation?
The hotels all used the same revenue management software. Plaintiffs argued this was basically a hub-and-spoke conspiracy to fix prices, using the algorithm as the hub for collusion.
But the court disagreed.
Yes. They ruled that the consciously parallel use of the same algorithmic software is not enough to prove an illegal agreement. Especially, they noted, if the software keeps each competitor's data separate and doesn't explicitly facilitate price coordination.
So using the same tool isn't automatically collusion.
Right. This landmark decision provides some legal clarity for the booming algorithmic pricing industry. It might make price-fixing cases based just on using shared algorithms harder to prove. Connecting this to the bigger picture, it sets a key precedent for our algorithm-driven economy, distinguishing parallel behavior from illegal conspiracy, a crucial distinction for antitrust law going forward.
And the Ninth Circuit also ruled on voting rights in Washington state.
Yes. They rejected an appeal in Soto Palmer v. Hobbs. This case challenged Washington's state legislative map for the Yakima Valley. The court affirmed the lower court's decision, which had adopted a remedial map.
Designed to do what?
Specifically designed to prevent the dilution of the Latino vote there, which would violate the Voting Rights Act. So this ruling is a significant victory for voting rights advocates, protecting the electoral power of the region's Latino community, ensuring fair representation.
Okay. So, Sam, let's try to pull all these disparate threads together. The executive actions, the congressional silence, the judicial interventions. What does it all mean? These past 48 hours weren't just isolated events, were they? They seemed to paint a picture of a very coherent, very aggressive governing strategy.
Indeed, Alex. When you look at these actions collectively, several cross-cutting themes emerge very clearly. They create a powerful blueprint, really, for this administration's approach. The first is what we've been calling the administrative blitzkrieg.
The rapid multi-front offensive.
Exactly. Executing policy rapidly, on multiple fronts, primarily through executive and regulatory power, hitting criminal justice, trade, immigration, public health, defense contracting, all within 48 hours. It overwhelms the capacity of opponents, the media, civil society, to mount a focused response to any single action.
And the congressional recess was key.
A key enabler. Not a coincidence, allowing maximum impact with minimal immediate friction or public debate.
And it's clear they're not just implementing policy, they're actively challenging established ways of doing things, even the institutions themselves.
That leads right into our second powerful theme, challenging institutional norms and expertise. There's a clear through line here, a deep-seated hostility toward established institutions, a distrust of nonpartisan expertise.
The CDC crisis being the prime example.
The most vivid example, yes. Purging scientific leadership for being not aligned with the president's agenda, raising fundamental questions about science's role in policy. We also saw it in the top-down directive to med schools, bypassing academic bodies, and using federal power to override local criminal justice, challenging state sovereignty.
And hints of challenging Fed independence, too.
There's been commentary around that, yes. This approach seeks to reshape, maybe even dismantle, institutions seen as part of a hostile establishment. Replacing their judgment with direct political control, ensuring alignment with the administration's agenda over independent expertise.
And those economic actions, like the India tariffs, they're not just about economics, are they? Wielded as a tool for broader goals.
Precisely. Our third theme, the weaponization of economic policy. Tariffs, sanctions, leveraging federal funds. These are being used as primary instruments for economic and foreign policy and domestic political goals.
The India tariffs aiming to force a foreign policy change on Russia.
Exactly. Not primarily about trade balances. And the cashless bail EO. Not about fiscal management, but forcing state-level social policy change by threatening funds. For you, the listener, this means understanding economic policy is increasingly a lever of power, creating a highly unpredictable, volatile environment for trade, federal-state relations, anyone reliant on federal funding, universities, companies. It's a powerful, often disruptive way to exert influence.
So given all this intense activity, these clear themes, What's the outlook? What should we expect as Congress comes back and these policies take hold?
Well, the actions of August 27th and 28th have undeniably set the stage for significant future conflict and instability across all branches of government, across society.
Legal challenges are coming.
Inevitable. For the cashless bail EO, the student visa rule.
Okay.
They'll be fiercely litigated, putting the judiciary right back in the center, like we saw with that NIH ruling.
And the CDC.
The turmoil there will have lasting, damaging consequences for U.S. health security. Rebuilding leadership, credibility, that's likely years of work, extending far beyond this administration.
And Congress returns to.
A fundamentally changed policy landscape, forced into that reactive posture we talked about, trying to use oversight and appropriations to claw back authority from an assertive executive branch that clearly prefers governing by executive fiat.
So this two-day period really was a blueprint.
A condensed but powerful blueprint of this administration's priorities and its methods. And for you, the listener, it signals we should expect these themes, the blitzkrieg, the challenge to norms, the weaponized economics to continue unfolding, probably with increasing intensity and potential for friction.
And that brings us to the end of this incredibly dense yet vital deep dive into the federal news update for August 27th and 28th, 2025. It's been an intense 48 hours, hasn't it? But hopefully your understanding is now significantly enhanced.
It's clear the consequences of these actions will keep rippling through our legal, economic, geopolitical spheres for weeks, months to come, impacting everything from public health to international relations.
We really hope this deep dive has given you that shortcut to being truly well-informed, providing those surprising facts, those profound aha moments that make understanding our government so essential.
And given the executive's aggressive use of authority, the challenges to institutional norms we've discussed. Maybe consider this as you go about your day. How might these recent actions permanently alter the balance of power between the branches of government, even after this current administration leaves office? And what does that mean for the future of policymaking in the United States?
Something for you to mull over, to keep questioning, and to explore further on your own. Thank you for joining us on the Deep Dive. Until next time, keep digging, keep questioning, and stay curious.